it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, a deep dive into a single topic from Odyssey's newsrooms across the country. Today, we're talking about guns and God in schools, entities that have been intertwined in the United States since its founding, but whose relationship with the laws that keep them separated is a little bit murky. Guns are always top of mind when it comes to American schools because we endure so many classroom shootings. Just this week, there was another school shooting in Denver and the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk on a college campus. When it comes to God in schools, President Donald Trump brought the conversation about the separation of religion and public school back to the forefront this week as well. He said at a meeting at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., that the Department of Education will soon issue new guidance protecting the right to prayer in public schools. What the guidelines will actually say, and whether they'll set off legal cases, is unknown. To have a great nation, you have to have religion. I believe that so strongly, Trump said. There has to be something after we go through all of this, and that something is God. Here's more on religion in schools with Professor Frank S. Ravitch from the College of Law at Michigan State University. He's talking to KCBS Radio in the Bay Area.
So talk about how has religion in public schools changed? When I was growing up, there was a definitive line between church and state.
Yeah, you know, that over time, it had eroded a bit, the separation of church and state, but it was really in June of 2022, just 2 years ago, when the Supreme Court overturned over 50 years of precedent regarding what's frequently referred to as the separation of church and state, and essentially shattered it. And there were actually two decisions that term, one of which involved a coach in the state of Washington. But in that case, the court overturned the major tests that supported the concept of separation of church and state, and replaced it with something called a history and tradition test. But actually, history and tradition very well might support separation. If, you know, it supports both sides. So they replaced it with a test that might be more of a wink, wink, nod, nod in favor of what they favor rather than an actual legal test.
I remember this now. This is the coach who wanted to do prayer, but, you know, in the huddle before or after games?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't in the huddle. It was at the 50-yard line, and the court kind of, the dissent in that case actually showed pictures of what really happened because the majority limited the facts so much. But yeah, the court held that he had a right, because it was essentially private speech, he had a right to engage in that speech without government interference. I think there are factual questions as to whether it was really private speech. But if it was, there was no reason for them to overturn 50 years of Establishment Clause precedent, because if it was private speech, then he has a right to speak whether it's religious or not. So that case, though, because it overturned the 50 years of precedent, has really, really limited the separation, more so than I think it really has been since the 1940s.
Has it surprised you how quickly that we've moved into sort of a gray area?
Ironically, we moved out of a grayish area into, like, I don't know, through the looking glass, essentially, into a completely different approach. So we went from having reasonably strong separation to having some modicum of separation all the way up through 2022, and then suddenly at 2022, everything changes to, like, what's likely to be very little separation.
And you see this also when you look at small towns where their school boards are making decisions and they're electing people who, you know, have certain points of view that previously may not have been allowed.
Yeah, you know, we're seeing that all over the country. There's lots of stealth, what are called stealth candidates running, which is a long time tactic of a lot of different interest groups. But people run as kind of like a general candidate, and then they get on to a school board or they, you know, town council or whatever, and then suddenly they start pushing a particular agenda. In the cases that you're talking about, it's an agenda promoting things like school prayer or, you know, creationism in the schools and things like that. Those things, to the extent that they're on the more extreme end, are probably still unconstitutional, even after what SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, did in 2022. But those school boards, we see it in Louisiana, as you mentioned, in Oklahoma. These laws and the actions of these school boards, they're trying to, in a lot of cases, create test cases to go up to the Supreme Court and see what happens.
Whether or not kids are encouraged to pray in their classrooms, we do know that many of them have trouble actually reading the Lord's Prayer. The National Assessment of Educational Progress releases what's known as the Nation's Report Card. And as the New York Post noted, the writing's on the wall if anyone could read it. Results showed that just 35% of high school seniors were proficient in reading. That's the lowest score since the assessment began in 1992. And the average score on the 12th grade math and reading assessments dropped 3 points from 2019. Here's more on the test scores from WCCO in Minneapolis.
And I reviewed these stats, the NAEP scores, again last night just to kind of get a grab on them. I think our high school students are an interesting situation currently. If you look at the number of kids who choose not to test on a yearly basis, or certainly on statewide assessments, it's telling us, you know, some conflicting stories. One, our students who are taking college-level coursework or AP and ID courses are at a record high, and they're doing incredibly well on that. So we've got that measure. And then we've got this reading test that shows that they're not passing a standardized reading assessment. So we're trying to figure out, those are completely different statistics. So I'm not surprised that kids aren't engaged in the reading test, and we're still trying to figure out, you know, what's truly happening with that population.
So what can be done? I mean, that is the million-dollar question. What are some key things that happen within a school day that can really make a difference?
Well, you know, the state has really launched into improving reading instruction, and really for the first time in my 35-year history, I identified materials that schools should use. And so we're just at the front end of a major shift in how we address reading in public education. Every state has trained every teacher in the science of reading, or every school district has trained every teacher, and all districts are currently in the adoption process for new materials. That should see an uptick in how students are performing in our schools. It takes a little bit of time. It's also coming at the time that we got $150 million out of public education in the metro this year. So there are some competing things, but we are on the right path towards addressing literacy in public education.
You've worked in Anoka-Hennepin, now you're with Minnetonka. What do you notice about some of the more successful cases where students are able to boost their achievement? Just anecdotally, what do you see?
Well, you know, intervention and success with students is relational first. In situations where schools prioritize connecting with kids first and then working on instruction, it really matters. There are pockets of success all over. If you measure, when I was in Anoka and in Minnetonka, do kids that are in our schools and with us for a couple of years make progress? Guaranteed. So stability in where students are going to school and places where kids are building great relationships with teachers, that matters. And then you mix in the science of reading work. I think we should start to see success, but it starts with relationships and connecting with kids.
Connecting with kids and relationships, how much of this falls on parents? Because you can sit and point, you know, fingers to some degree. Parents got to be on top of what their kids are doing, turned in assignments, going to school, things like that. But what would you say is the importance of parental involvement in all this?
Well, it has to be a partnership. 100%. There's no doubt that kids that are involved in reading at home and have frequent interaction with vocabulary before they come to school hit the ground running. So how as much as we can empower our parents when they have 3 and 4 year olds to be, you know, thinking about letters, be thinking about shapes and all the things that get students kindergarten ready, that matters. And, you know, one of the pieces I'll tell you now, in a time of school choice, it's harder for public schools to know who's going to be coming to them in kindergarten. So it probably has to be a statewide preparation for 3 and 4 year olds, because a lot of school districts are picking up kindergarten students that aren't their community residents, Minnetonka included. So, you know, we've just got to do it as a concerted effort statewide to help parents do the right things to support their children coming to school.
One of the interesting stats I found in the national data that was released on Monday was that the highest performing students, those at the 90th percentile, are doing just about as well as ever. So you wonder, is there something missing within our school systems overall, nationally, that we're missing out on helping some of the lower performing students, yet at the same time able to boost and launch some of the brightest students?
I think if you look at data over time, people that can navigate the school system consistently do well. And, you know, wherever they go, they find success. What we're looking at now, and, you know, there's a lot of factors in society. I'm not going to pick all of them, but, you know, a parent's work schedule, parents' ability to be available for children when they're practicing in the evening, all those things, it has to be a partnership. I think if you look at historically when the states change standards or we have some type of crisis like a pandemic, the hardest hit are kids in poverty. So if you look at that poverty threshold and if you look at the correlation between poverty and proficiency, it's so direct. So supporting, you know, our state funding stream heavily favors poverty, that the concept is correct, but it's about helping our kids in poverty come to school and be prepared and, you know, partnering with those parents so that they feel confident that their kids have those skills. That what stat you shared doesn't surprise me, but that is really where our focus has to be. If we want to rise all boats, we've got to rise the tide and help those students who are feeling less prepared coming into school.
That's very true. Well, thank you so much for kind of picking apart a little bit of these stats.
Public school wasn't even in session across the country when we had our first mass shooting of the school year. 17 kids were injured and 2 were killed when someone opened fire during mass at a private school in Minnesota. That, plus the fact that this happens over and over and over again, has people wondering if gun laws will change in Minneapolis or anywhere else. Here's the Adam and Jordana Show at WCCO in Minneapolis with more.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly,
you know,
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland,
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Tori Van Oot is coming to us live from the Nationals Stadium in Washington, D.C. Tori, the lawmakers come back in January. Will walls, you know, the marchers are, you know, people in protest for gun reform in the wake of the Annunciation shooting are asking the governor, including the mayor is one of them, to call for a special session to discuss, to demand reforms in the wake of the Annunciation shooting. Is this going to happen?
Walz has said he wants to call a special session. He wants to call the legislature back. And he has not given any indication that he has changed his mind on that. So I would expect him to call the legislature back. Now, as we've talked about, I'm sorry, more people are walking in the concourse.
No, it's okay.
I hope it's not too loud for you.
It's okay.
But
nope.
I would expect him to call a special session. The bigger question is what they can actually do. What can they actually get done?
Right.
And we've talked about this. The politics are complicated. We have a very narrowly divided legislature. It will return to a tie in the House likely next week when Melissa Hortman's seat is filled. And there does not appear to be votes for additional gun restrictions in the Republican caucus, as far as we know, which controls half the House. You can't even get it to the floor without their buy-in. There also isn't, we don't know if there's support for assault-style weapons ban or legislation like that within the Democratic caucus. They didn't have the votes when they had full control, and some of those suburban members, more moderate members who are on the fence about that sort of issue, they are not committing. They are saying kind of devil's in the details. I have to keep looking at this. It's not clear what will actually happen. But lawmakers, legislative leaders, and the governor were talking yesterday, kind of the first step in those negotiations of what a special session might include. And so we will see what happens when they get back. And, of course, the governor can call them back, right? He has the sole power to call them back and convene them. But once they're in, it's up to them. You know, he doesn't get to control what comes up on the floor. He doesn't control when they adjourn. So it ultimately becomes in the legislature's hands what kind of things they can do. And Republicans have proposed some of their own ideas that don't include gun control. So we'll see if some of those will be on the table.
That don't include gun control. Yeah. Tori, I know what's going to happen because right now I can see into the future.
Got a crystal ball. Can I rent it from you? I'd like it.
Yeah, you know what it's going to say? You know what my crystal ball says right now? Nothing is going to happen. Nothing is ever going to happen with the people that we have in power and the lobbying system that we have right now. Nothing meaningful will happen. The Democrats can hide behind their safe storage laws. The Republicans can make up stuff like more mental health checks. But no meaningful legislation will pass to stop the gun violence in this country because clearly we value guns over school children's lives. That is what my crystal ball is saying right now. You don't have to respond to that because I know you're a reporter and I'm just a silly talk show host and I get to have opinions. But I have completely lost faith in our lawmakers to have any kind of moral clarity about gun violence in this country. And you don't have to respond because, again, that's okay. That was just what my crystal ball says is even if he calls them back, and maybe that's a useless effort, completely futile, because he knows, it'll look good for me if I call them back, but they will do nothing. Okay, full stop. I'm moving on.
I was just going to say, as opinion stances. I don't do things like that. What you hear from people who have been longtime proponents of additional gun laws at the legislature is the vote math is complicated. This is a politically complicated issue to pass. But some of them have some hope from their perspective that they can pass that something as terrible and tragic as the Annunciation shooting will motivate people to action. On that front, there have been other states that have passed restrictions on assault-style weapon bans. Now, gun rights advocates argue that some of those is questions about the constitutionality. A lot of it is the devil in the details, right? Like, what are you actually proposing doing? What are you proposing restricting? So we'll just see. And there's also questions about funding for school safety, funding for mental health. Those are things that may be easier to get the votes for. They may not satisfy someone in your shoes, Jordana, but like there may be some things that they may do. So we'll just have to see. And we're still waiting for the actual packages from the Democrats, right? And from Governor Walz. Governor Walz said a week ago, I'm going to put out my package of what I think the gun reform should be in a couple of days. He hasn't done that yet. So some of it is going to be, what are they actually proposing, right? And some have even said you should put a constitutional amendment on the ballot instead of so lawmakers would vote. To let voters choose not to know. I don't know if that would be challenged in court. That's another thing that's been thrown out there. Mayor Carter said that. We talked about this the other week. You should let cities decide. I don't think that's going to pass the legislature. But there's a lot of different things that might be on the table. So we'll just have to see what they come to.
Maybe they'll surprise me, but I have been so disappointed in so many politicians that I have very low expectations.
While legislative action is still a question, WBEN in Buffalo, New York, reports that security is high at private schools across their region, including the use of armed guards in hallways. Here's more.
I'm Brian Masurowski. Armed security guards are coming to every Catholic elementary school in the Buffalo Diocese. The move comes 2 weeks after two students were killed and 21 others injured in a shooting during a mass for Catholic school students in Minneapolis. Parents received a letter from the diocese yesterday. 29 schools in total will have an armed guard and a security consultant also being hired to assist principals in shaping safety plans.
Most schools in Western New York have either a full-time security officer and or a part-time SRO. You definitely see a lot of this directed towards high schools, but more and more throughout Western New York, even middle schools are starting to see the presence of armed security.
Well, that is Jeff Rinaldo with the Tarian Group, who's providing that security. The cost of the security offset by the foundation of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Buffalo, but a tuition increase is expected to keep it going next year.
We know the news can feel dark and overwhelming as people navigate back-to-school stress with the chaos of the American political system, a struggling economy, bad news about test scores, worries about school security, and more. So we're going to try to leave you with something uplifting today. WWL's Newell Normand talked to Kent Broussard, who at 66 years old is the oldest freshman at Louisiana State University. And yes, he's with the band.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You know the old adage, never give up on your dream? Well, my next guest is the epitome of that, Kent Broussard. He's a 66-year-old tuba-playing LSU band member as a freshman, and he joins us. Kent, welcome to the show.
Yeah, Newell, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the show, and I'm humbled and honored to be talking to the WWL team as well as all the listeners. I've been a WWL fan since the late 60s when I used to listen to all the Saints games before the NFL. Yep. And you guys have done an awesome job for decades and continue the good work.
Well, Kent, I got to tell you, you've been an inspiration to a lot of people to never give up on your dream. So if you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, tell us how this all started for you.
Right. For many years, we had season tickets to the LSU games, and it all started back around 1968, 1969, when we first started going to LSU games. And at the time, I was really interested in football, but then all of a sudden I would hear the band and it caught my attention, the sound, the orchestral view that they gave to the fans and how much the fans really enjoyed the music that they played. And it always stuck with me back from 1968. And I never lost that passion for music. I actually played in the high school band and then at college at Southeastern, and always had that in the back of my mind that it's something that I wanted to do. Obviously, you know, life gets in the way. I got married, and then had children, and had a real long career, in the work world. And I've had the opportunity to do this after I retired.
And did you always play the tuba?
I did initially in high school. I played it for 4 years, and then I played it for 2 years at Southeastern, and then I played the trumpet for 2 years at Southeastern in my final junior and senior years. But the sousaphone was always the first love. Yeah. It's always got that bass. It's always got that bass sound, and when the bass is not there, the music just sounds hollow. And I love that. And I love that bass sound.
Well, you know, it's interesting about the sousaphone players. To me, they were always the most dominant presence in the band, right? As the band's marching anywhere, especially like during Mardi Gras or otherwise.
Yeah, that's definitely still the case today, particularly because of the presence. You know, the size mm-hmm. of the bells and just the size of the general instrument, and you know, and when you're playing with when you're playing with several hundred other bandmates, it just blends and it sounds really full and gives a great sound if you can, if you don't overplay. And, you know, and we try not to do that here, and we try to blend all of the sound in to make it the sound that everyone has come to love and admire over the decades.
So, Kent, you register for school again. I made a promise to myself that I would never go back to school, but maybe I should not say that.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. Yes, I had to register. I had to register for school. I did. I had to register for school. But there were a lot of other hurdles that I had to cross. I had to make sure that I was eligible, right? I had to make sure that I was eligible for Tiger Man, and I found out that I was. Then I had to apply for school, and the first hurdle was that was my transcripts from Southeastern. And that was from 1981 and 1982. So I called Southeastern kind of laughingly, do you guys even have transcripts from that long ago? And sure enough, they did. And they were able to provide the transcripts to LSU. And luckily, my application was accepted, which was a big hurdle in and of itself. LSU, from what I understand, had around 70,000 applications for the freshman class. And I think they had like 7,800 slots. So the fact that I was even accepted was a big hurdle for me to be able to cross.
Right. So then you let the band, I guess it's a competition, right, to some extent.
Well,
you go out, you try out, like it is for the football team.
It is an audition process. So what happens is you send in a first audition tape, and they will tell you whether or not you made it past the first round. And if you make it past the first round here at LSU, then you're invited to what they call preseason camp. And during the preseason camp is where they do really comprehensive evaluations, not just on your playing, but on your marching, your sight reading, and just your overall cultural fit. Because as in every business and professional organization like the band is, they have a culture that they're trying to maintain and to make sure that everyone fits. And so basically it was a 5-day audition process. Even though all of the playing and the marching took place in one day, it was just getting to know everyone and getting to understand what each person was about during those 5 days.
So Kent, I guess nobody actually looked at you, right? When you walked in.
You
didn't get a single look, did you?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's like, you know, I've had people ask me if I'm a teacher and I'm just taking classes, or what am I doing? Am I auditing a band class or am I auditing classes? And no, I am a student. I am a full 100% student. I am actually talking to you right now from right outside the union. I have class in less than an hour, and I've got work. I've got work like everybody else.
So you walk in, nobody's looking at you. Well, I mean, what was the reaction?
And this is important to me. I'm trying just to be one of the team, because I am.
Sure.
You know, I didn't do this for individual attention. I did it because I love the sound, and I love the fact that the students come together as a group, and it's not just the band that works hard. It is the Color Guard and it's the Golden Girls that actually work for months. And most of these band guys and gals work for years to get to this point. And people just don't see all the work that goes into it. So I'm just trying to fit in. I'm trying to be a part of the team, and you know, I'm offering to do things that regular band people do. And so I'm just trying to be a part of that team and just trying to blend in as much as I can. As you can about imagine, that's not as easy as it may seem currently.
But you really, it's got to be such a ride, and you are an inspiration. So let's fast forward. First home game. You're coming down the hill. You nervous?
You know, I was not nervous to the extent that I thought I was going to be, and this is why the staff at LSU does a great job at getting the band, the Color Guard, and the Golden Girls really ready for marching down the hill, as well as the halftime shows and the pregame shows. And
well, the, you know, for me, if I miss the pregame salute, I just soon miss the game.
Well, that's what a lot of people think.
Without that, it's like, you know, if I got held up in traffic, it's like, oh man, I just ought to just turn around, go home and watch it on TV.
Yeah, well, you know what? You can still get the pregame salute on the march down Victory Hill. And that's, you know, that was the epitome for me. And I'm trying to concentrate, right? So I'm concentrate and I'm hearing people talk, you know, call my name out as I'm walking down the hill because they can see me. I'm all the way on the right hand side. So I'm up against the curb and I'm trying to keep a straight face and trying to stay focused for the task at hand. And I think it did a pretty good job, but that's the key, right? Everybody has a job to do and I'm no different. And I'm there just as one of 325 and, I want to make the band look good and sound good. And hopefully we've been able to do that so far.
So to put this in context, just so everybody recognizes this dream started in 1968. You were about, what, 10?
About
12. 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And here we are in 2025. And, you know, and I got to imagine, I get chills down my spine when y'all do the pregame salute still. And that's...
And by the way, so do I. So do I, yeah, by the way.
You know, and... In fact, in preparation for this today, I watched the pregame salute three times last night. Just, you know, I could have watched it once.
And
I'm going to watch this again. I watched it again.
It is the sound. It is the sound that the band is known for. And to be able to make that sound on a consistent basis for all the decades. And, you know, it's just synonymous with Tiger fans. And it hasn't wavered. If you think about it, that sound has not wavered, and I'm just happy and glad to be a part of that for this fall semester.
So let me ask this, not to belabor the point, but so you do you come down the hill. That's one experience, but when you get into Death Valley, right?
Yeah.
And everybody's rushing to get to their seats for the pregame salute. I mean, it's like a mad day. You know, you did it for years as a fan.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking
about. Certainly did.
And, you know, you're there in the end zone. Are you looking around and just like, oh, my God.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't going to – like, again, I was focused and really trying to keep my attention on the task at hand. And at least for this game, I was not on the field for the pregame salute, but hopefully I'll be on the pregame salute field in the future. But just the overall experience in Tiger Stadium from a band perspective, it's different. It's a different feel because people respond to what we do, particularly the student section. You know, that's incredible. The student section is incredible. Mm-hmm. But it's a good feeling to be able to do something that, you know, that 100,000 people respond to. And I thoroughly enjoyed being up in the stands with the bandmates and listening to us play as a group and watching the Color Guard and watching the Golden Girls dance for the full game. And let me tell you, we don't stop. We do not stop. I don't know how many songs we played for the first game, but it was numerous. And it was a long day, but it was a rewarding day because that was the first time and that's always something special.
Kent, let's be honest here. It must have been hard for you to play that instrument because you had to wipe the smile off your face, right?
Well, it is. And like I said, I need to stay focused. And there were a couple of times that I probably cracked from people that I knew that were calling my name, but in all fairness, trying to stay focused is the main thing, you know, and keep your mind on the task at hand, and just remember your training. That's the most important thing. Remember all the times we've gone through it and what to do and how to do it. And when everybody does it right, it looks fantastic. And so, so I look forward to continuing to do that, for the rest of the season.
No doubt. You are a testament to never give up on your dream. You never know when the opportunity is going to present itself. to fulfill it. And
yep.
You are. And I got to tell you, the community, I think, is responding in just an unbelievable way. I was telling my coffee group this morning that I was going to interview you today because they always ask me, who you got today? I said, you know, I got Kent Broussard, the 66-year-old tuba player that's living out his dream. And they're like, oh, my God, I got to listen to that. You know what I mean? Everybody's excited for you. And they're all pulling
that.
For you.
You know what? I appreciate that. And you know, I think the outgrowth of me doing this, Newell, is a couple of things. One, you know, as people get to retirement age or close to retirement age, take a look at what I'm doing. And, you know, I didn't know if I was going to make it or not, but I tried. And as I say, the only failure that you have is not trying. And it's certainly worth the effort. And hopefully people are seeing that. And maybe somebody's going to do something that they've always wanted to do because they're seeing my story. On the other end of the spectrum are the young people. If they see me doing this kind of stuff at my age, maybe some young people might want to do some things that they have ideas about, like, say, develop an app or start a business or something like that, that they may want to do and give it a shot. And again, in their case, the only failure is not trying.
No doubt. No doubt. What an inspiration. Kent Broussard, best of luck to you. And I look forward to seeing you down on the field.
I do too. I do too. Hopefully sometime this season, I'll be able to get there.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of On Deadline, written and produced by Christy Strauser and by me. You can subscribe to the On Deadline podcast through the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.